act quickly to continue to introduce resolutions in the Senate and in the House to push the U.S. out of Yemen.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Shireen Al-Adhemi is a Yemeni scholar, activist, and assistant professor now at Michigan State University, speaking to us from East Lansing. And Maggie Michel, AP reporter, speaking to us from Cairo, Egypt. This is Democracy Now! We have a Democracy Now! Full-time job opening for a broadcast engineer here in our New York City studio. Find out more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Malkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Trina Nadura, Matt Nade, and Libby Rainey. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Amy. The time is now 5 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland. The KBOO Evening News is next after these messages.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the August Amzi After Dark, featuring Insexuality, Ultrasonic Love Songs, and Death Dances from the Panamanian Rainforest on Wednesday, August 29th at 7:30 p.m. at Amzi in Portland. What does the world sound like to an insect or a bat? You can find out by exploring the insect music you've never heard before in surround sound under the Panamanian stars. Again, that's Amzi After Dark, featuring Insexuality, Ultrasonic Love Songs, and Death Dances from the Panamanian Rainforest on Wednesday, August 29th at 7:30 p.m. at the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, 1945 Southeast Water Avenue in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Air quality.
Monsanto has been found guilty over Roundup liability.
And in international news, a bridge has collapsed in Genoa, Italy.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 14th, 2018. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Kyle Carrezzi. Air quality in Portland will get worse through this afternoon and evening. Wildfires burning in eastern Oregon, combining with continuing 90-degree-plus weather, have brought the air quality index in Portland area into the 160 range, according to the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. An air quality index between 100 and 150 is described as, quote, unhealthy for sensitive groups. This includes children, older adults, and people with heart and lung conditions. If this applies to you, try to avoid going outdoors as much as possible. Today's air quality index, as of 3 this afternoon, was 162, which a DEQ says is unhealthy for everyone. Even healthy adults may begin to experience adverse effects after spending time outdoors today, and sensitive groups may be more affected than normal. Stay safe and be updated on the situation by going to oregon.gov/DEQ.
Monsanto Corporation has been found liable for causing cancer with its popular weed killer, Roundup. Lee Johnson, a former school district employee in Solano County, California, sued Monsanto after developing non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Johnson was periodically soaked in Roundup when the wind changed as he sprayed the product, or when spraying equipment broke. The jury found that his cancer had indeed been caused by Roundup and awarded the former groundskeeper $289 million. Monsanto has announced that it will use its vast army of attorneys to appeal the verdict, guaranteeing that Johnson, who is dying, will never see a penny in compensation. As 5,000 similar lawsuits remain pending, The news tanked Bayer Corporation's stock. Bayer, which owns Monsanto, lost $11.4 billion in stock valuation over news of the trial loss. Monsanto had worked hard to conceal the carcinogenic properties of Roundup and its principal ingredient, glyphosate, battling the Environmental Protection Agency's research since 1983, and even telling Johnson personally that his cancer had nothing to do with Roundup. The trial verdict appeared to be a wake-up call for international regulation of Roundup, as renewed efforts for glyphosate ban appeared in the European Union. The French agricultural minister called for ending glyphosate use, saying the trial verdict was the opening shot in a war against the product, and the German legislature is sunsetting its licensing of glyphosate. Greenpeace is urging Australia to ban a Roundup-like weed killer containing the chemical. In related news, Scientific American has published an article strongly warning about broad genetic damage from the gene editor CRISPR, even as Monsanto has announced its plans to have CRISPR-edited strawberries and other fruits on the market within a few years. The article says CRISPR can cause tumors.
At least 20 people are dead after the Morandi Bridge in Genoa, Italy, collapsed. The bridge, which spans the Po Serva River and is three-quarters of a mile long, carries traffic between Italy and France. The collapse occurred today just before noon local time during a torrential rainstorm. A section over 300 feet long fell around 140 feet onto city streets below. According to the company which operates the bridge, Autostrade per Italia, the structure was undergoing stabilization work. The company also said in a statement that the cause of the collapse will be the subject of an in-depth investigation. Italy's Deputy Transportation Minister, Edoardo Rixi, has said that the entire bridge will be demolished, adding that it has shown signs of problems in the past. However, he would not elaborate. The bridge is one of only two major highway bridges that span the waterway. Its loss is expected to cause serious traffic problems for the area. This incident further adds to criticism that the state of Italy's infrastructure is declining.
A London man has been arrested on suspicion of terrorism after driving through a group of pedestrians and crashing into a gate outside the United Kingdom's Houses of Parliament building. London's Metropolitan Police said they are treating the crash as a terrorist incident, and the investigation will be handled by their counter-terrorism division. Law enforcement said in a statement, quote, "At this stage, we are treating this as a terrorist incident, and the Met's counter-terrorism command is now leading the investigation," unquote. The head of Scotland Yard's counter-terrorism command, Assistant Commissioner Neil Basu, added that the priority for investigators is to identify the suspect and his motives, but the man in custody is, quote, "not fully cooperating with police." Streets in the surrounding area were closed off to traffic due to the heavy police presence following the incident. London's ambulance service said they treated two people at the scene for injuries. However, they were not believed to be seriously hurt. Another report from law enforcement stated that three pedestrians were wounded, but only one remains in the hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. Witnesses say they saw the silver Ford hatchback head towards Parliament at a high speed while hitting bikers and pedestrians along the way. Video captured by surveillance cameras shows the small car abruptly turn across several lanes of rush hour traffic and enter the security channel outside the Parliament building. The vehicle appears to accelerate before ramming into the gate. London Mayor Sadiq Khan released a statement saying, quote, "The response of Londoners today shows that we will never be cowed, intimidated, or divided by any terrorist attack," unquote. Prime Minister Theresa May added, quote, "My thoughts are with those injured in the incident in Westminster, and my thanks to the emergency services for their immediate and courageous response," unquote. Responding to the event, U.S. President Donald Trump tweeted, quote, "Another terrorist attack in London. These animals are crazy and must be dealt with through toughness and strength," unquote. It has been noted that most British lawmakers are on summer vacation, and normally the area would be much busier. There is not believed to be any further danger to the public in connection with the incident.
A report released last week found that Oregon is doing some things right and some things wrong when it comes to policies for preventing cancer. One area where the report found a serious need for improvement is in tobacco use prevention. KB reporter Teresa Mitchell has this story from the Oregon News Service.
Oregon's performance on fighting cancer is a mixed bag, according to a report out today. The American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network's 16th annual analysis measuring states on cancer prevention policies says Oregon is falling short in key areas such as tobacco regulations. Christopher Friend with ACS CAN says tobacco is the most deadly product on the market and it's imperative that lawmakers control it properly. The report singles out the state's cigarette tax, currently at $1.33, which is below the national average of $1.75. Friend says taxes are one of the most effective ways to prevent smoking.
Most adult smokers want to quit, and that increase of tobacco tax is a really good reason to quit. When it comes to young people, by increasing the cost of tobacco products, you're making it more difficult for young people to access tobacco products in the first place.
Tobacco use is a leading cause of preventable death in Oregon, killing about 5,500 people a year. Friend commends Oregon for raising the age to buy tobacco to 21 last year. The report also says the state's expansion of Medicaid is helping to reduce incidence of cancer. But Oregon gets low marks for its spending on tobacco prevention programs. The state spent about a fifth of the amount the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends in fiscal year 2018, about $8 million compared to the agency's suggested $39 million. Friend says that leaves Oregon's kids vulnerable to taking up smoking.
Looking at how much the tobacco industry spends in Oregon compared to our prevention dollars, our state is outspent 13 to 1. That means that young people in the state of Oregon are almost constantly barraged with marketing from big tobacco companies.
The report also includes a pain policy report. Friend says it's important that cancer patients aren't vilified for their use of pain medications. He says Oregon was one of the first states to implement a mandatory reporting database to prevent abuse of pain medications, but that it's time for legislators to update that database.
That was KBOO reporter Teresa Mitchell with a story from the Oregon News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from the Oregon Zoo Summer Concerts, presenting Punch Brothers and Andrew Bird Saturday, August 18th at the Oregon Zoo Amphitheater. Starting at 7 p.m., doors open at 5 p.m., and all ages are welcome. Tickets and more information can be found online at zooconcerts.com.
Earlier today, six local religious leaders were detained by federal officers at the Portland ICE facility on Southwest McAdam Avenue. The group of leaders, along with around 80 other people of faith, marched to the facility and asked to meet with Acting ICE Regional Director Elizabeth Godfrey. They were hoping to deliver a letter demanding the release of more than 100 detainees from the federal prison in Sheridan, Oregon. The group said if their demands were not met, they would attempt to disrupt ICE operations. Several marchers, including the religious leaders, held hands and blocked the driveway of the facility. After about 30 minutes, federal officers told the group to disperse or face detainment. Six of the leaders who refused to move were then promptly arrested. Last week, three other religious leaders were also detained. Rabbi Deborah Kolodny, Reverend Michael Ellick, and Reverend Barbara Nixon were all arrested after similarly blocking the driveway at the ICE facility on August 7th.
The Pennsylvania Supreme Court has released a grand jury report in which more than 300 Catholic priests were found to have committed sexual assault on over 1,000 children. The report, which took nearly 2 years to investigate, shows a scale of abuse that previous reports have never reached. In nearly 900 pages, the report goes into great detail of how the church hid the abuse of children for decades. The 23 people who made up the grand jury, based on their report on internal documents subpoenaed from the six dioceses under investigation, as well as testimony from victims and more than a dozen priests, most of whom have admitted to their acts. Due to the statute of limitations, almost all of the instances of abuse cannot be prosecuted. Two priests from different dioceses are being charged with crimes that fall within the statute. One priest sexually assaulted two children almost monthly for several years. The report not only provides hundreds of pages concerning the abuse, it also details the internal cover-up by the Catholic Church. Additionally, the report gives recommendations on how laws should change in the future. This includes eliminating the statute of limitations for the sex abuse of children and increasing the number of people allowed to make civil claims against the church.
The FBI agent accused of lying about the shooting of Robert Lavoie Finicum in January of 2016 has been found not guilty. A member of the elite FBI hostage rescue team, Agent Joseph Astorita was facing two counts of making false statements and one count of obstruction of justice in relation to the fatal shooting of Finicum. Finicum was a spokesperson for the militia group Citizens for Constitutional Freedom, which staged an armed occupation of the Malhern National Wildlife Refuge in eastern Oregon in January of 2016. Law enforcement attempted to arrest Finicum and other militia leaders after they fled from a highway roadblock in eastern Oregon. State police troopers fatally shot Finicum when he appeared to reach for a loaded handgun in his jacket pocket. Prosecutors argued that Astorita lied to his supervisors when asked if he fired his gun. The jury has found him not guilty. Billy J. Williams, U.S. Attorney for Oregon, released a statement following the announcement of the verdict saying, quote, "We strongly believe this case needed to be brought before the court and decided by a jury. Our system of justice relies on the absolute integrity of law enforcement officials at all levels of government," unquote. The FBI has declined to comment on the verdict or respond to questioning regarding Astorita's future at the FBI.
Portland police have said that two people attempting to rent electric scooters at an Old Town Chinatown road sidewalk were hit and injured Monday night by a drunk driver. According to law enforcement, the two people were treated at the scene but did not suffer serious injuries. A 37-year-old man allegedly drove onto the sidewalk and hit them before driving away in a silver car. One of the victims said it was, quote, "just a miraculous thing that nobody was seriously injured," unquote. The witness reportedly followed the suspect, Sheldon Scott, and officers located him around the corner from the crash site. Scott was booked into the Multnomah County Jail on a variety of charges, including driving under the influence of intoxicants, reckless driving, failure to perform the duties of a driver, and attempted assault in the second degree. He is being held on $25,000 bail. Monday's event appears to be the most significant incident involving scooters in Portland thus far. The devices arrived in Portland only a few weeks ago as a part of a four-month pilot company. Three companies are currently operating in the city, and hundreds of scooters are located throughout town. On Friday, a scooter rider was injured in a bike lane after being hit by a car on Northeast 122nd Avenue. The rider was not wearing a helmet, but he was not seriously injured in the incident. E-scooter riders are required to operate the lightweight devices within city streets or in authorized multi-use paths. State law also mandates that riders wear helmets.
And now, it's time for the Middle East Minute with Alan Minsky, produced out of the studios of KPFK.
This is the Middle East Minute Plus, and I'm Alan Minsky. A Yemeni governor has survived a roadside bomb attack in Aden, Al Jazeera reports. An attack in Yemen's southern city of Aden has apparently targeted the convoy of a Saudi-backed Yemeni official. Witnesses told the Reuters news agency a roadside bomb hit the convoy of the governor of Taiz province on Tuesday. Amin Ahmed Mahmoud, who is a member of the internationally recognized government in exile of President Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi, survived the blast. Quote, "The governor was not injured, but some of the escorts were injured and taken to hospital," end quote, an official at the governor's office told Reuters. With logistical support from the United States, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, a war has been waging in Yemen since March 2015. Economists are warning of a new economic crisis after the collapse of Turkey's currency. So far this year, Turkey's currency, the lira, has lost more than 40% of its value. On Monday, the lira hit a new all-time low versus the U.S. dollar. Ripple effects from the Turkish economic crisis are being felt across the globe, partly due to Turkey's reliance on foreign lending, especially from European banks. Last week, President Trump raised new tariffs on Turkish metal exports, greatly exacerbating the crisis. In other news, President Trump has signed a record-setting $716 billion military spending bill, marking a $82 billion increase over the current year. This has been the Middle East Minute Plus, a joint project of KPFK and Jewish Voice for Peace.
Weed grown in the Pacific Northwest is being sent to Yemen, where the nation's civil war has brought more than 8 million of its 27 million citizens to the brink of starvation. The U.S. Agency for International Development, which administers the Food for Peace program, has purchased the crops in part to support American farmers. The wheat was then given to the United Nations World Food Program that will ship and distribute it within Yemen. The WFP's Yemen Country Director, Stephen Anderson, said in a news conference in Portland, quote, "We're going to do our best to get food assistance to the people who need it most," unquote. In the past 2 weeks, seven ships filled with 176,000 tons of wheat have been sent from Portland to Yemen. Senator Jeff Merkley and Representative Mike McLean said that in a joint statement that Oregon is using one of its, quote, "most effective peace-building tools." They continue to say, "We see these agricultural programs representing the best of American values, culture, and policy."
Now, from Berkeley's KPFA, Anne Garrison discusses WikiLeaks' Julian Assange as the lightning rod of a new Cold War.
WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has become a lightning rod of the new Cold War. Last week, via Twitter, the Democratic Party served WikiLeaks with a lawsuit alleging that the organization collaborated with Russian spies to interfere in the U.S.'s 2016 presidential election. Hungarian-born scholar George Samueli, speaking on last weekend's 50-hour YouTube vigil for Julian Assange, said that WikiLeaks released a goldmine of information, particularly the diplomatic cables that he's relying on in his own research.
I've been working on the origins of the new Cold War. And for that work, I've been heavily reliant on particularly the WikiLeaks cables, which is a fascinating insight. This is the public figures who shaped the new Cold War. And much of what the information that you get there is contrary to the official version that you receive from policymakers, denizens of think tanks, mainstream media, of U.S. officialdom that went out of its way to be as friendly and as cooperative toward post-communist Russia as possible, and that it was only the mean and nasty Russians who were so unreliable and turned against us. The WikiLeaks cables offer us a fascinating insight into what really happened. And I found it an absolute goldmine of information. So yeah, I'm heavily reliant on that. And for that, I feel I and many others owe a debt toward Julian. I mean, whatever we can do to repay him for what he has done for us, I mean, that we should try to do.
So Mueller describes NATO's expansion since the end of the First Cold War as a public protection racket.
NATO is really a kind of a public protection racket. I mean, it's there's no enemy that NATO is supposedly defending anybody against. So what is it actually doing? So it has to create its own crises to justify its existence. So it kind of triggers the very crises, then it provides claims that it is the solution. So for instance, as it moves eastward, the Russians get very upset. So then we got the various kind of the Baltic states, Poland, they start getting very agitated and saying, oh no, we need more NATO, we need more NATO protection. NATO then comes up, well, yes, we have to move in. There's a huge dangerous Russian threat looming. We need more resources for NATO. So it becomes like a protection racket, which is, nice place you've got here. Shame if anything were to happen to it. So this is how NATO operates. And so, now NATO is much, much bigger than it ever was in the days of the Soviet Union. And what is it? What is its purpose? What is it supposedly doing? And under Trump, who supposedly campaigned against NATO, it's now getting even more resources. And it's clearly creating these zones of instability.
And that was Hungarian scholar George Zemueli speaking on last weekend's YouTube vigil for Julian Assange. Archives of the vigil can be found at unity4j.com. In Berkeley for Pacifica, KPFA Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
The chief of the World Health Organization is raising the alarm as the conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo exacerbates the conditions giving rise to an Ebola outbreak. The death toll in the DR Congo stands at 41, and more deaths have been reported this week. The region of the outbreak is home to 8 million people. The WHO chief is calling for a ceasefire to allow access to war-torn regions where Ebola is believed to be spreading. He's also called for immediate usage of the unlicensed and experimental drug to combat the outbreak. In May, the U.S. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases said that it was carrying out the first human trials of the drug MAB114 to test it for safety and tolerance. Ebola is currently killing people on the border with Uganda and Rwanda. This comes on the immediate tail of the regional outbreak that killed 33 people. An experimental vaccine for first responders is already in use, with over 200 people vaccinated. In related news, tests in the United States found that monoclonal antibodies exposed to Ebola will also kill the Marburg virus.
It's time for today's report from National Native News. the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Federal Communications Commission is considering a rule change for licenses normally reserved for education and public broadcasting. As Emily Schwing reports, Washington's Confederated Tribes of Colville are calling on the agency to prioritize reservations for improved communication.
They're known as EBS, or Education Broadband Spectrum Licenses. And they've been reserved for education and public broadcasting since the 1960s. In the 1980s, the FCC allowed licensees to lease out their spectrum. This spring, the agency proposed a rule change that could expand license eligibility to tribes. Rodney Costin is the Colville Tribe's chairman.
It is a safety and health aspect on our reservation, you know, because we have so many needs and unmet needs because all of our communities are rural.
Connectivity on Washington's largest reservation is pretty spotty.
You know, we're getting a lot more visitation, especially, you know, in Lake Roosevelt, Banks Lake, and other places that, are highly visited for recreational purposes or for fishing or camping.
And with that comes an increased need for things like emergency response and wildfire management. The FCC is considering a number of options, including auctioning the licenses. Costin says many tribes don't have the financial resources to outbid large telecommunication companies that might buy them. A public comment period closes in early September. I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
Final payments are being made in Keepsiegel versus Vilsack, closing the case, attorneys announced Monday. The class action lawsuit was filed in 1999 for Native farmers and ranchers. A $760 million settlement was reached in 2011, but payments issued in the initial rounds of claims in 2012 left about $380 million unclaimed. Remaining legal hurdles have been cleared over the distribution of the remaining funds. Awards will now go to benefit nonprofit organizations serving Native American farmers and ranchers, and millions will go into the Native American Agriculture Fund, a trust created as part of the modified settlement. The decades-long battle resolves claims that the U.S. Department of Agriculture systematically discriminated against Native American farmers and ranchers. This week, the Quapaw Tribe of Oklahoma will officially become the Quapaw Nation. The Miami News Record reports tribal members voted in favor of the name change in July. Citizens also voted on leader of the tribe. The incumbent, John Barry, will keep the chairman position. The tribe has more than 1,300 registered voters. More than 800 participated in the election. Los Angeles City Council member Mitch O'Farrell and the L.A. City County Native American Indian Commission announced Monday plans for the first official celebration of Indigenous Peoples Day in both the city and county. Day-long events will be held in downtown L.A. on Monday, October 8th. A sunrise ceremony, powwow speakers, and other activities are being planned. The councilman introduced a motion in 2015 to establish the day. After a number of hearings with the Native American and Italian American communities, the city council voted in 2017 to establish Indigenous Peoples Day on the second Monday in October. Cities across the U.S. have moved to replace the federal Columbus Day holiday with Indigenous Peoples Day. Navajo Code Talkers being honored with a tribal holiday. Celebrations Tuesday in Window Rock, Arizona include a parade, wreath-laying ceremony, a 21-gun salute, and guest speakers. Navajo Code Talkers, an elite group of Marines, used a code developed in the Navajo language to aid the U.S. in World War II. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Family Works Project designed for prisoners returning home to family life. At 6, it's preference. Then at 7, it's calculated conversations. Tonight's weather, another hazy night with temperatures in the mid-60s. Tomorrow, the heat wave keeps on coming with highs in the upper 90s. Today in history, on this day in 2003, a major outage knocked out power across the eastern United States and parts of Canada. Beginning at 4:10 p.m. Eastern Time, 21 power plants shut down in just 3 minutes. 50 million people were affected, including residents of New York, Cleveland, and Detroit, as well as Toronto and Ottawa, Canada. The quote of the day is from comedian Ron White, who said, quote, "I believe that if life gives you lemons, you should make lemonade and try to find someone whose life has given them vodka and then have a party."
And now, get ready for the point puzzle.
It's time for the puzzle.
All my life's a circle. Sunrise and sundown. Moon rolls through the nighttime. Till the daybreak comes around. All my life's a circle, but I can't tell you why. Seasons spinning round again, the years keep...
If you're a regular listener, you know that this is the second week of a two-week challenge. A few months back, I introduced the idea of compound word chains, where the second half of the first word becomes the first half of the next word. Here is a compound word circle. Sidewalk, walkway, wayside, where the last word circles back to start the first. The challenge is to send me your own three compound word circle. So again, in a compound word circle, the second half of one word becomes the first half of the next, and the second half of the last word is the first half of the first word. For example, sidewalk, walkway, and wayside. Send me your circles by this Saturday, August 18th, and I'll randomly select one to be this week's winner.
Rise and fall, turn away, 'cause all life is really just a circle.
This has been Pearl Stark with your point puzzle for the week of August 13th. The point puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
Four young girls fought off a man who was attempting to kidnap them outside a convenience store in Michigan. According to police, the girls hit, kicked, and then threw coffee on the man. Authorities said the girls, who were in middle school, were attacked last week at a speedway in Millington, a small town about 80 miles northeast of Lansing. The 22-year-old man, who was identified as Bruce Hipkins, quote, grabbed the youngest girl around the head and told her she was coming with him, unquote. The others then started defending themselves. Authorities said Hipkins let the young girl go and grabbed another one of the girls by the hair. They added that he was, quote, kicked and hit by the girls until he let go. The girls were not harmed in the incident. Hipkins was arrested on numerous charges, including kidnapping. Law enforcement said, quote, "I think they did great. They did exactly what they should have done. They fought the suspect and they won," unquote. The father of the two girls, Aaron Eckhoff, said his daughters and their two friends were walking home at about 10 p.m. on Friday from a town-wide festival when they stopped by Speedway for drinks and snacks. 13-year-old Allison was attacked first. He grabbed her face and neck, and her friends immediately started scratching and kicking him, and one girl threw coffee on his face. Then Allison took off running to a nearby restaurant and a bar, screaming for help. The father said, quote, "I was raging mad, but you have to look at the fact that our daughters are fine. I'm very proud of them. I haven't let them leave my arms yet. They're so unbelievable. How they reacted was just amazing. It was true bravery," unquote. According to Oliver, Hipkins' family said the suspect is on the autism spectrum, a claim police have not confirmed. Hipkins is being held on a $250,000 bond.
Black History 365 celebrates Black achievements and honors moments in Black history for each day of the year. In today's episode, Motown group The Marvelettes.
Black history is happening every day. It's time to start thinking of it outside of a day or a week or a month. We hope to inspire you by enlightening you with those people and events that should be learned from and forever remembered.
Today is August 14th. On this day in 1961, The Marvelettes' first single, Please, Mr. Postman, one of the first number one singles recorded by an all-female vocal group and the first by a Motown recording act, was released. The Marvelettes were the first major successful act of Motown Records and Motown's first significantly successful girl group after this release.
Achievements and events are not confined to the past. Make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365, BAM 365, where you find every day Black history is made.
After a tax cut gave an average of $50,000 per year to the top 1% of income taxpayers, President Donald Trump has signed an $82 billion increase for this year's Pentagon budget. $21 billion of the funding will go to nuclear weapons increases, including $65 million to produce a battlefield nuke to be launched from submarines. The spending increase will only lead to a less than 3% raise in military wages, but weapons manufacturers will receive a bonanza. The president's tax cuts, popular with his conservative base, will add only around $60 to persons earning less than $25,000 per year. It is also anticipated to increase the deficit by $912 billion over last year, an increase of 39%. According to the Congressional Budget Office, corporate taxes are dropping 27% due to the new largesse. The Committee for a Responsible Budget, a nonpartisan and nonprofit group, estimates that the policies of increased spending plus tax cuts for the rich will result in a tripling of the federal debt over two decades.
And now, it's time for Labor History in Two, from host Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1936. That was the day that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act into law. The act was a key piece of the president's New Deal, a series of federal programs responding to the ravages of the Great Depression. Social Security would provide an income for retirees and the disabled to ensure that they did not slide into complete destitution. On signing the bill, President Roosevelt, known for delivering memorable speeches, addressed the press. He said, quote, "Today, the hope of many years standing in large part fulfilled. The civilization of the past 100 years, with its startling industrial changes, has tended more and more to make life insecure. Young people have come to wonder what will their lot when they come to old age. The man with a job has wondered how long that job will last. This Social Security measure gives at least some protection to 50 million of our citizens who will reap direct benefits through unemployment compensation, through old age pensions, and through increased services for the protection of children and the prevention of ill health." He went on to say, quote, "The law will flatten out the peaks and valleys of deflation and inflation. It is, in short, a law that will care of human needs and at the same time provide the United States an economic structure of vastly greater soundness." Over the past few decades, politicians have increasingly sounded the alarm that Social Security will not remain viable as the large baby boomer generation retires and draws benefits. Yet despite those who seek to attack Social Security, it remains a bedrock of the social safety net for millions of Americans. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
The Vacaville Police Department rushed to save animals from a wildfire. As the Nelson Fire sped towards Solano County, Officer Carly Stone was working down the road when she realized just how close the fire was getting to the animal shelter. She jumped into action, as body cam footage shows her and another officer repeatedly running in and out of the shelter, saving all the cats and dogs within minutes to spare. They were able to save all 60 animals in just 10 minutes. Officer Stone said, quote, We just did what we would hope anyone else would do for our own pets, unquote. An employee of the shelter added, quote, we just put full faith in them, and we were thankful that they were so great to us, and not only to protect people, but animals too.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sam Bowman, Lucas Campbell, Yasmin Kobanoglu, Al Kahn, and Teresa Mitchell. The producer tonight is the entire PM News production team. Our engineer is Sam Bowman. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. Stay tuned after this newscast for a segment from Making Contact, focusing on the Osborne's Family Works Program, the first comprehensive parenting program for a men's state prison. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Kyle Carezzi, and coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7 it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, host Jacqueline Keeler takes over with her podcast, Not Your Disappearing Indian, and asks how sovereign or indigenous nations, excuse me. At 9 on Political Perspectives, Lisa Loving welcomes the Portland Harbor Community Coalition with ways you can help clean up the Willamette. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's The Food Show for people who like to eat. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Good night, Yasmin.
Good night, Kyle.
Good night, Sam.
Good night, everybody.
This is Making Contact. I'm your host, RJ Lozada. The Osborne's Family Works program is the first comprehensive parenting program in a men's state prison. Founded in New York, Family Works operates as a counterbalance to the numerous challenges in keeping a family together. Producer Sylvia Ryerson brings us this piece from New York City.
In the closet, we have a big bin.
Oh, this is a birthday card.
Birthday card from this year. He wrote, "You're loved a lot, and you must know it. But all the same, this comes to show with love on your birthday, love, Dad." And we have a bunch more. We just have a big memory box.
That's Gia, reading the card she got from her dad celebrating her 9th birthday. Gia was not yet 2 years old when her dad went to prison. Now she's an outgoing 4th grader whose favorite things are drawing and eating cotton candy. I'm sitting with Gia and her mom, Marnie, at their kitchen table.
I met my husband, Jim, when I was 12 years old in the neighborhood that we both grew up in, Hell's Kitchen. And then we didn't see each other for years and years. And then we met again when we were like, I was about 34. And we went on a date. And from that moment on, we've been together. 30 days later, he asked me to marry him and gave me an engagement ring. And it was like a fairy tale until he got arrested. It was November 5th, 2010. And from what we were told, there was a confidential informant that said that he had some stuff in the house that shouldn't have been there. And when they came in, the stuff that they were looking for actually wasn't there, but they did find a gun, a firearm. He did tell them when they walked in that it was there, and he did tell them where it was. And he said, you know, my wife and my kids have nothing to do with this, it's mine. But they arrested all of us. And then they took my kids to the ACS office downtown.
Although Marnie was never charged in the crime, because of it, she lost her job, and her co-op board kicked her out of her apartment. It took her 8 months to get the full custody of her children back. When she showed up in court for Jim's sentencing, she listened, in shock, as the judge sentenced him to 12 years for criminal possession of a weapon.
When it happened, I just like nearly collapsed because I just couldn't believe it. I thought because he was a repeat offender that, you know, they have to give him a little extra time. But 12 years is a really long time.
At the time, Marnie's daughter Kim was 3 years old. Gia was about to turn 2, and she had an infant, Frankie, who was just 3 months old.
I do have times where I feel like a single parent, but then again, I know that when my husband was home, he was a really great dad, very attentive, always on the weekends, you know, he would take them everywhere. And now, you know, it's been hard for all of us because, you know, when we go on visits, like when they say time's up and everybody has to get up and say goodbye, then it's hard.
Tonight, Marnie is getting the family ready for a visit to see Jim the next morning.
So how many pages do you have of math tonight?
Two.
For many years, Jim was incarcerated in far upstate New York, a 7-hour bus ride one way, which made trips with the kids difficult and rare. Now he is at Sing Sing Prison, about a 2-hour train ride north of the city, and they try to visit him once a month. But tomorrow will be a special visit. They will be attending Jim's graduation ceremony. Over the past year, Jim has been participating in Family Works, a comprehensive parenting program offered by the Osborne Association, a New York-based nonprofit. Tomorrow, the family will be celebrating Jim's accomplishment together. He's completed over 50 hours of coursework and classes, all focused on how he can be a better parent and partner. Gia tells me she's excited for the visit and already has her clothes laid out for the early morning departure.
Sometimes in my dream, I feel like I don't have a father. So, yeah. When my father gets out, I hope that we are starting a new life. I'll be 12 years old. I am 9 right now. He has missed so many things.
At 8:30 a.m. the next morning, inside the Sing Sing prison visiting room, I watch Jim wrap his 7-year-old son Frankie in a big hug, calling him by his nickname, Beast, as he proudly introduces him to his friends.
Come here, Beast. Come here, Beast. Say hello.
The visiting room feels festive. Tablecloths are laid over folding tables, each topped with stuffed animals for kids to take home, and the Sing Sing prison band is playing. After opening remarks from prison and Osborne staff, Family Works graduate John Lewis takes the mic.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I am totally nerve-wracked right now. This is like my first time doing something like this. Ask y'all to bear with me because I'm truly like scared right now.
Lewis's hands are shaking as he unfolds a piece of paper at the podium. It's a letter he wrote to his 8-year-old son, Jeremiah, who's sitting in the audience.
This is the hardest letter I have ever had to write. I want you to hear the truth from me. I am in prison because I broke the law. Your mother is not to blame for me being here. You are not to blame for me being here. Just because I am away from you doesn't mean that I don't love you. This is kind of touching for me because I love my son and I want him to not make mistakes that I've made. It is hard being a man facing the truth, but when you make a mistake, you are the only one who can correct it. Make sure you do everything that you can to undo any harm or pain you cause. Until I get home, I want you to know that I think of you night and day. Obey your mother's rules. Respect her and love her because she needs you now more than ever.
At the heart of the Family Works program is a demanding 16-week parenting class, which covers a breadth of topics. Imani Davis was central in developing the Family Works curriculum, and she took the mic after John Lewis.
I want to acknowledge you for every letter that you wrote that went unanswered and that you continued to write. I want to acknowledge you for your willingness to take yourself on to be, and to begin to come to terms with the harms that has been done to you and the harm that you have perpetuated. But most of all, I want to acknowledge you for using love as a form of resistance against a system that has been actively and intentionally dismantling our families since slavery, that you chose love as your act of doing that.
Davis's connection to Family Works is personal. When she was 6 years old, her father was sentenced to 25 years in prison. Davis's mother is Elizabeth Gaines, the president and CEO of the Osborne Association. Gaines first had the idea of starting the program over 30 years ago, right after Davis's father was arrested.
My daughter shared with some of her friends that her father was incarcerated, and parents like canceled play dates. And so we realized that it was stigmatizing for the kids, but also that I really didn't know what was the right thing to do. What should I tell them and what might happen? And it occurred to me as we were trying to figure out how my kid's dad was going to parent them, that there was this big gap in how prisons thought about men in prison as being fathers.
So, with her own sense of urgency, Gaines reached out to dozens of experts in psychology, neuroscience, and human and adolescent development. One of her early collaborators was Dr. Carl Mazza, a doctor of social work, and together they began to map out the curriculum. Central to the program's philosophy is that participants must understand the impact their incarceration has had on their children's lives in order to begin to mend and grow this relationship. Each class session begins with a short video, followed by a facilitated group discussion. Here's Dr. Carl Mazza in the video for the first day of the parenting class.
Consistency in children's lives is enormously, enormously important. A child needs to know that the person who loved me last week loves me today and will love me next month. So once daddy is gone, the child's world, the foundation of the child's world is now gone. Because if daddy goes today, what's to prevent if I go to school tomorrow that mommy won't be here, or grandma, or auntie? The child becomes...
The course stresses the importance of establishing this bond of love despite one's incarceration. And in order to do so successfully, a key point of the class is dismantling the assumption that just because someone is in prison, it does not necessarily mean they are a bad role model for their child. Again, Dr. Mazza.
You need to separate that, sir. Yeah. And that there are wonderful, loving, caring qualities within each one of you that you need to accept first before you are able to relate those to your children.
For Gaines, the course is a careful balancing act, definitively underscoring the importance of being a parent while incarcerated, while accepting the limits of one's parental role.
So you have to really get down to the core of what really is a parent. And, you know, if you can't take them to the soccer practice, what can you do? How do you have real discussions?
This is why, Gaines says, the curriculum has an enormous focus on communication skills. Skills to use not only with one's child, but equally importantly, with the child's primary caregiver on the outside. All of this, Gaines insists, is critical to successful reentry. In focusing on how one can be a parent from prison, the program aims to prepare individuals for returning home to their families.
With your release from prison and your transition back to the family, your main job in terms of this is to understand how your family functions now. You can't go in and say, daddy's home, things are changing. Your initial job with your children is to understand your kids from a different perspective, from being a father out in a larger world.
According to a 2009 report from the Sentencing Project, over half of the people in state and federal prisons are parents of minor children. 1.7 million children in the United States have a parent in prison on any given day. Black children are 7.5 times more likely than white children to have an incarcerated parent. Given this staggering reality, Gaines says, supporting family connectivity for children with incarcerated parents is critically important, both for the child's well-being and for the parent's successful reentry. And yet, the system works to do the opposite, as Gaines lists all the pieces that should be in place, yet generally are not.
Parenting education is part of it. Decent visiting is part of it. Keeping prisons closer to families so that people can visit. Making phone calls affordable. All of the things that allow families to sustain themselves as families and be able to understand the impact and really mitigate it. I think the difference for kids is extraordinary.
Back in the Sing Sing visitation room, I find Jim and Marnie after the ceremony. Jim is listening attentively as Marnie catches him up on the latest plans for Halloween.
Says he wants to be the nurse. And Frank was thinking about being a Care Bear too. He was going to be a blue Care Bear. She was going to be a pink one.
I ask Jim what taking this class has meant for him.
I really grew up in jail, and I didn't know what it was to be a father. I didn't know how it was to be, like, soft towards children, you know. I was never raised that way. I was raised in a hard life, and that's all I knew was a hard life, you know. You could throw me in, any jail you want, and I could live, I could survive. But when you put me around the kids, it's like, wow, this is really hard, you know.
But Jim says, the class has helped him to be more patient, to listen more, and yell less. Gia is sitting by Jim's side, and she has an assignment for her dad.
You need to make me a baby book. I don't have one.
Need to make you a baby book?
Yeah, I don't have one.
You're not a baby no more, though.
Yeah, but still, memories?
I remember very well.
What do you remember?
I remember you as a little baby at one time. I remember when you was in the wash basket.
All too soon, the time is over.
The visit room is closed. We ask that all civilians and visitors come to the front so that you can exit. The visit room is closed.
Jim and Marnie brace for the moment they knew was coming all along. Marnie watches as Jim gives Gia one last kiss.
Take care. I love yous all. Be good. Gigi, give me kisses and hugs. I love you.
Love you too.
You sure?
Yeah.
Visitors, you need to make your way to the front. It is time to go. The visit room is closed.
Reporting from New York, I'm Sylvia Ryerson for Making Contact.
After leaving the visitation room, Marnie and the kids took a 2-hour train ride back to New York City. For Halloween, I heard that Gia was a cutie pop, Frankie was a minion, and Kim was Minnie Mouse. I also hear Gia's baby book is in the works. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Making Contact. We're sharing stories about families impacted by the prison system. And just to give you a snapshot of an idea, in 2007, of the 1.7 million children in America with a parent in prison, more than 70% were children of color. 62% of parents in state prisons are more than 100 miles away from home. And over half had not had any personal visits with their children while in prison. And that's it for Making Contact. For more information on these programs or any of our other stories about the prison industrial complex, please visit our website, radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director. Marie Che, Anita Johnson, Monica Lopez are our producers. Sabine Blazan is our audience engagement manager. And Vera Tykulsker is our development associate. And I'm RJ Lozada. Thank you for listening to Making Contact.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. The Finance Committee meets this month on August 23rd at Cider Riot at 807 North East Cooch.
KABU is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society's new concert season, which starts September 21st of this year and runs through May of 2019, all staged at the Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland. The Portland Folk Music Society is pleased to present a lineup of national and regional artists, including Molly O'Brien and Rich Moore, the Kathy Kallick Band, the Honey Whiskey Trio, Legends of the Celtic Harp with Patrick Ball, True North, Tish Hinojosa, Pat Donahue, Nina Gerber and Chris Webster, and Dave Stamey. And for the first time, the Portland Folk Music Society is offering season ticket packages at prices below single show rates, either online or at the door. For more information, go to the website kboo.fm and look on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the August Amazigh After Dark, featuring Insexuality, ultrasonic love songs, and death dances from the Panamanian rainforest on Wednesday, August 29th at 7:30 p.m. at Amazigh in Portland. What does the world sound like to an insect or a bat? You can find out by exploring the insect music you've never heard before in surround sound under the Panamanian stars. Again, that's Amazigh After Dark, featuring Insexuality, ultrasonic love songs, and death dances from the Panamanian rainforest on Wednesday, August 29th at 7:30 p.m. at the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, 1945 Southeast Water Avenue in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.